fair, you stay there, you'll know our next guest. It's 20 years since Eoin O'Mahony captured the stunning sight of three humpback whales on film while working on a supply ship on the Kinsale gas field off the coast of County Cork.
It was just kind of like a normal routine day. We were just sitting between the two platforms, drifting. We had no propulsion system running at the time, so the vessel was very quiet. I was off watch, and I suppose it was mid-morning, and I got a call from the captain, come up to the bridge immediately. Well, we have three whales on just approaching the gas field from the west, so we were seeing an awful lot of bottlenose dolphins and common dolphins at the time, so I said it was worth recording, you know. So I ran up to the bridge and I grabbed the camcorder. It was charging at the time, so it was all good to go. So it started filming straight away, and to our amazement, they approached the vessel and came to the point where they were actually nearly touching the sides of the vessel, port and starboard side, with their pectoral fins, which was amazing. They circled the vessel for, I'd say, the best part of a good hour, you know. And none of us had any experience, or we'd never seen anything like that before, you know. And it was kind of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to get to see these amazing creatures up close, you know. It was like a cameraman with David Attenborough. It was amazing to film these creatures up close. They came so close at one stage. One of the three humpback whales, he nearly put his head on the stern roller, which is at the back of the ship. He was having a spy hop, having a look around to see what was there. And there was three or four guys standing right by the stern. So in the footage, you can see that they were extremely close, which is fascinating. And the spray, it sometimes, with the whales exhaling, you could get the kind of that funny boiled broccoli smell from their breaths every time they came close. And the camera was getting sprayed as well. I had to clean the lens several times. But it was an amazing day, I'll never forget it.
Oh, well, I'll never forget that description. Boiled broccoli smell. What a beautiful description. Well, news of the footage reached the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group, and identifiable details of individual whales were clear enough to form the first entries of the organisation's catalogue of sightings. The animals were named number one, number two, and number three. And, skip forward 20 years, well, almost 20 years to the day since the original sighting, number one and number two have been spotted again, still swimming together in the same neck of the woods. Simon Barrow is chief officer and CEO of the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group, and he's also a lecturer at GMIT, and he joins us now from the Galway studio. Simon, this is great news, is it not?
It is. It's a brilliant story. I think Eoin's backstory on how he got those first video footage is brilliant as well. And I think it's what the Whale and Dolphin Group is all about. You know, we as scientists like to collect the records, the data, but then we can package those piece of information into a story. And when the story is told as eloquently as Eoin, and the story spans 20 years, it just makes us realise how amazing the natural world is, I suppose.
Just for the benefit of the listeners, again, that's what I am. Why number one, number two, and number three? Why do you do that? Why don't you give them names, for example?
Names are useful to remember things, and we have got some with names. We had a humpback that was first seen off Hookhead breaching, and I think it was being filmed by Crossing the Lines at the time. So that's known as Hooky, just so that we know who we're talking about. But I suppose I like numbers. Number three, actually, well, the third one that Eoin filmed, we didn't get a fluke picture of it, so that was never identified. And number three is called Boomerang. It's the first one that the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group photographed in 2001, because it was 2 years later before Eoin heard that we were interested and offered up the video. So number three is Boomerang, because it keeps coming back every year since we've recorded Boomerang in inshore Irish waters.
But you don't know if that's the number three that Eoin filmed, because you didn't see his tail, or do you?
No, we don't, no.
Yeah, so it's your number three, in
it
fact.
Is,
yeah,
and ironically, yeah. Number three had been seen the week before. We saw number one and number two off Kerry this year, so how amazing is that?
Simon, what inferences do you draw from finding one and two together after all these years? Why would this happen? I mean, is it just a statistical accident? They both happen to come here every year and happen to be together when you were around. Or is there something deeper? Could there be some kind of strange relationship between large whales? After all, they are polygamous. Monogamy wouldn't make any sense in these creatures, so we think. What could they be doing together?
Yeah, it's a good question, Richard. And I think we have a very simple view of things. We as people like to learn something, put it in a box and say, that's that. And of course, the more you dig deep into these relationships, the social networks, the more complex it becomes. So we're a feeding ground for humpback whales and the breeding ground grounds written in the tropics this year. We had a first success in finding at least one breeding ground for Irish humpbacks in Cape Verde. That's good. So it's a feeding ground. So why would whales associate on a feeding ground? I looked a bit of the literature since this finding, and it says that males will associate with females on the feeding grounds within a season, and they increases their chances of breeding on the breeding grounds. So maybe they try and hook up with a female on the feeding grounds like Ireland, and then follow her, stay with her all the way down to the breeding grounds, and therefore have a better chance of mating. So that makes sense.
So it's like taking her out to dinner and then having...
Yeah, long courtship.
So success afterwards, yeah.
And now, number one is a male. We biopsied number one, I think, maybe 10, 15 years ago. So we know he's a male. We don't know number two. Number three is Boomerang, and he's a male as well. We also biopsied him. So assuming number two is, say, a female... It is really unusual for a male and a female to associate across seasons. So maybe it's a coincidence that he just happened to find a female and he just happened to be number two 20 years later. Or, as we suspect, there's probably something stronger going on there in terms of an association. And another layer of interest is if you look at the relationship between the whales together on the feeding grounds like Ireland, females are more likely to associate with other females that share the same genetic material, so are related in some sense. But males don't. So if number one and number two were females, you might say, well, somewhere back in the way, they must share some kind of genetic material. They are related in some way. So we don't know. It'd be nice to find out if number two is a male or a female. So as I said, it just gets more complicated. It gets more detailed. It gets more interesting. And I suppose the personalities and the intricacies of the social relationship between these large whales emerge. So, yeah, it's fantastic. And I suppose... You know, it's 20 years. Can you imagine me going to Ferdia and saying, Ferdia, I've got a 20-year research plan with the Wireless Service funded? They're not going to do that, and I don't blame them, and I wouldn't expect them to. So through citizen science, through empowering the likes of Owen, for letting Owen know that if you send your data to the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group, we will take good care of it, and we will share it, and we'll add data from other people from all around Ireland, and we can start building up these amazing stories, which span a 20-year history. So, yeah, I think it's a fantastic story, and it just makes us, I suppose, have more respect and impression of humpbacks and other whales and dolphins in Ireland.
Simon, we did have a three-year study recently which we were involved in together, the Observe programme, and what amazed me about that was just the diversity of the big whales in particular that were moving up and down off our shores on an annual basis. This is obviously another part of that equation, but do you want to give us a quick summary of what we found out from the Observe project?
Yeah, it was the Observe that I led was the acoustic side of it, and UCC led the aerial survey. So we were putting in sound recorders in deep water, 2,000 metres off the shelf edge. It's very quiet at 2,000 metres, so the detection range for whale sound. Large whales vocalise at a very low frequency, and low frequencies travel a long way. So we reckon we could detect things like blue whales and fin whales up to maybe 200 kilometres away, because the sound travels well, and we had very quiet environment that we put the recorders in. Fin whales were recorded throughout the year, especially in the winter, especially in the autumn. There was less detections in the summer, but that we associated with them not being vocal. If you're not vocalising, we can't detect you acoustically. So they're probably there in as abundance in the summer, but we just didn't detect them.
Can you tell an individual whale by its sound, or can you just tell what species it is?
Yeah, you can't. You can track individual whales if you have a series of recorders, and the time of arrival of that sound means you can actually translocate to where the animal is. It's difficult, but it can be done. We actually have a PhD student who's looking a little bit more into that at the minute in GMIT.
So you could actually get the sound of number one and number two if you were lucky.
It changes all the time. I mean, these are, as Ferdia said, we had blue whales and fin whales. Blue whales are actually quite abundant. Well, they're quite vocal off the west coast in the autumn and winter. Humpback whales we didn't detect very much, but the project didn't run through the winter when humpbacks are probably migrating along this migratory pathway, which the shelf edge is, from feeding grounds to the north, the Arctic, to probably the Caribbean. I think the humpbacks we get in inshore waters are probably a different population and behave quite differently. But it's interesting, Aina, the humpback whale song, which I think we have some of, is it changes all the time. So it's not like I have my unique accent, my voice. You might recognise my voice. My voice would be changing all the time. So if you talk to me in 2 years' time, I'd sound very different if I was a humpback whale singing. So it's not very good for that, but certainly you can recognise species, but not necessarily individuals.
So So the other whales then, the blue whales and the fin whales, you were saying they don't always make sounds. So do they make sounds when they're looking for mates? Do they make sounds when they're communicating there's food to be had? Why would they go by making noise at one time and go by not making noise at another time?
Well, if you think about humpback whales, they're probably the most studied whale, large whale on the planet. We know more about them than anything else. And you recall Roger Payne's Song of the Humpback Whale, which was recorded and made into record and limited in the 70s. And yet, we still don't really understand the function of whale song in things like humpback whales. So we're only really guessing what the function is for the larger whales. Obviously, they need to communicate with each other. Obviously, they need to navigate. So they probably use sound for all those functions.
Simon, whale singing is probably putting out its CV, in a sense. It's proclaiming, it's sending out information about itself and listening out for information about others out there. Now, if you're in the mating business, you will be very anxious to get a good version of your CV out, and you'll be very anxious to assess the CVs of possible partners. This might be a curious explanation for why two very old whales come together. I remember with swans, when they became widowed and they repaired, the older swans repaired with older widows and widowers. They didn't go for nice young swans down the way that you would expect them to do. Now, I couldn't actually prove this because statistically I didn't get big enough samples to actually stand up, but I am certain in my own mind that if an old swan dies, it looks for an oldie as a next partner. Now, could that be hard? You see the CVs go out, the two whales, he might go for the one that's old and experienced, that has survived for 20 years and therefore has the genes for survival. She's a good bet or he's a good bet, and this might bring them together. This is a fantasy theory, but is it possible something that's going on?
It is. You know, I've read a few reviews about the function of whale song, and the classic is that they're males singing and attracting mates, and that it's like a lek in a bird's. So you have all these whales singing, and the females make a choice based on the song on who they're going to mate with. Is it the duration of the song? I can sing for 30 minutes, therefore I'm a big, strong, powerful whale. I am fit, I am good to mate with, we'll have strong offspring. Is it the complexity of the song? Is the more detail in the song impress the females, and she makes the choice? So it's a nice theory, and it stands up, and you think that's fantastic. But when you test that theory in the field and you see, well, if you've got a singing male, who checks out the male? You would expect that there'll be females checking out the male that's singing and saying, yeah, I fancy you, I love your song, let's go and make some babies. But most of the whales that actually check a singing whale out are actually other males. So I love the idea. What I like about science is you have an idea, you have a hypothesis, you test it, and you realise actually all your preconceived ideas are completely wrong and something else is going on. So you rethink it and come out with another one. So it could possibly be that.
Do only males sing? Do the females not sing?
Males predominantly sing, but I was trying to dig out a study for this programme where I recall females singing too, but I couldn't actually find it at short notice. So I think there is some records of females singing. Remember, whales are supposed to sing on the breeding grounds as a lek, but actually we now know they feed in the feeding grounds. So one of the reasons we were out and photographed number one, number two, we were actually going out off West Kerry to deploy a sound trap, a recording device, to see if we could record humpback whales singing in Ireland. And we bumped into the humpbacks while we were out doing that. So it would be lovely to record more whales singing in Ireland, and in theory they would have a northeast Atlantic, maybe Irish song that they sing as well. So that was our ambition, to try and record humpback whale singing.
Simon, I always thought it'd be useful to get the bat researchers and whale researchers together. They're two groups of animals that rely for a surprising amount of their communication on sound, and in terms of the research that's going on, the bat ecologists are trying to work out what the calls mean. Bats clearly have social calls as well as their feeding buzzes. And I think there's probably a lot to learn from sitting down and discussing not just the analysis of the sound files, but also just things like the practicalities of microphones and how you actually record this information, how you analyse the WAV files that come out the other end. Maybe the All-Ireland Mammal Symposium at the end of November might be an opportunity to sit down together.
Yeah, look, and I think they do, Ferdy. I think, as you said, a lot of the software that marine people use are generally borrowed and stolen from land. So a lot of the software is made by bird researchers looking at birdsong and terrestrial mammals as well. So I think there is a good overlap in the software. Maybe the hardware is a little bit more difficult, trying to make things soundproof for the marine. But then sound travels better at sea. So I think recording sounds actually is more straightforward. And one of the things I was very pleased with on our Observe program you mentioned, the Observe Acoustic, is the logistics of going off the west coast of Ireland, dropping down and recording 2,000 metres of water, 2 kilometres of water depth on a specific spot, going back 3 months later and popping it up and recovering and downloading the data. To actually physically do that in a challenging environment, that's what impressed me as the PI. I just wanted to get the data and then the clever people can analyse the data. So I think those challenges can be, we can do it, and it is easier at sea. But certainly, I must admit, I don't know what the BAT people are doing in terms of primary research in Ireland, so it would be a fantastic opportunity to find out and share our experiences.
That's real Dr. Doolittle stuff. What about the fin whale, which appeared in the River Liffey a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, it was a sad story. I think it was always doomed to be a sad one. We actually got a report of a whale blowing off Sutton in North Dublin the day before on the Tuesday. And one of our directors, Connell, lives in Santra, and he went out and he didn't see the whale, but he talked to people on the beach. And we thought, well, it's probably a minke whale, which is common in the Irish Sea, but it sounded a bit strange. So then when this whale appeared in the Liffey the following day, the chances are it was the same one. So I suppose we knew at that stage this whale had come down the coast and gone into the Liffey. It did take us a while to actually positively identify it. It's not always that easy. We were only looking at kind of old, not so good video taken on people's smartphones. And eventually we got a video of the white right lower jaw, which is a diagnostic feature of fin whales. And it's important for us to know what species we're talking about, because if it was a minke whale, well, they're common in the Irish Sea, so it's in the wrong place, if you like, Dublin Port, but it's not outside of its normal habitat. Mm-hmm. When we realised it was a fin whale and had been seen the day before close to shore, that's not what fin whales do. I mean, there are fin whales in the Irish Sea, but they're not that abundant, and certainly they're not close to shore. So the prognosis was never going to be very good. It was an unusual behaviour in an unusual place, and swimming into Dublin Port on the Liffey is not normal for fin whales. So
this is the second largest animal on the planet, next to the blue whale.
Isn't it unbelievable, Derek, to think that the second biggest animal on the planet swims into your capital city? And it's a pity in some ways it didn't survive for longer to give people better opportunity to see it, because it's a phenomenal opportunity. I suppose our concerns were that it had to be disorientated, it had to be sick, it had to be in not good condition, and we didn't want to add that to its stress. So,
but you don't know. I remember years ago you were carrying out, is it a post-mortem, is that what you call them?
Yep.
On the white-sided dolphins?
Yeah.
On the West Coast, must be 20-something years ago.
1994 it was,
That's your memory. But have you done that with this fin whale, or was it just buried in the ground and that was it? Did anybody have a look at it to see, was it plastic in its gut? What could be the reason?
Yeah, logistically it is very difficult. I mean, it was sad that it was found dead the following day. We're not exactly too sure. It did have collision wounds on it, and we're not sure if it got hit by a ship pre or post-mortem. Obviously, Dublin Port is a very, very busy area, so it would have been nice to know that and get more data.
But the post-mortem wasn't carried out, was it?
No, and I think...
Well, it's buried in Dollyman Strand. Presumably they could dig it up for you.
Yeah, it's not something like with the dolphin. You can, you know, we have a 3-year project part funded by the National Parks and Wildlife Service to recover dolphins and porpoises for post-mortem, and that's in a very controlled environment. We take them to a regional lab in Cork, and we do it with, you know, professional vets, so at the Department of Ag. A large whale is just logistically more difficult. It's possible, it can be done. I think you need to have your structures in place before it happens. Now, this is not an unusual thing. We get large whales stranded, both live and dead, every year, and probably in increasing numbers, because certainly humpback whales are increasing in number of their population, and possibly fin whales as well. So I think this will happen more and more again. So I think we should have a structure in place that we can respond. It's interesting that in England, a humpback whale swam in the Thames almost the same day, which is ironic. That died. That was recovered for post-mortem. It did look like the ship had hit it before it died, because the marks were on the top of it, not the bottom of it, and they're doing a full post-mortem. So I think it is a waste opportunity, but I don't think it's something you can say, right, there's a whale, let's do it tomorrow, because you have to get track vehicles, you have to get JCBs, you have to think of disposal of carcasses, safety of people, veterinary pathologists, sampling gear. So it's something that we as
I know it's going to be a very smelly job, because it would be decomposing at this stage, but nonetheless, you would think that, well, the only way to find out what killed it is to actually do a post-mortem, analyze toxicology and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, we've taken samples of toxicology, we've taken samples of genetics, but we could have taken more from the whale. I mean, we did a partial post-mortem on a sperm whale in Sligo in April, helped by Sligo County Council, who provided JCBs. We had 2 or 3 hours before the tide came in to get as much as we could. But we did a bit, and I think it's something we should aspire to do as a state, because it is a waste opportunity. There was quite a lot of criticism on social media that we didn't do something about it, but I don't think people understand the logistics of cutting up.
No, by the way, Simon, I'm not criticising at all, on the contrary.
No, but we think it's something we should aspire to do as a state, because it would be a good thing.
Well, considering that that we were the first designated whale and dolphin sanctuary, the waters off the coast of Ireland. Is that not true? 12 miles or something like that?
200 miles,
is it?
EEZ, yeah, 200 miles.
200 miles, excuse me.
And just to follow up on what Simon was saying there, the logistics of carrying out a post-mortem obviously are enormous, particularly on a large animal. We've even found, to come back to the rabbits and hares, that unless you actually get the animals really, really fresh, literally like within a few hours, then what you found is that internally the proteins start to break down and your ability to really diagnose what's happened becomes very, very compromised. And invariably, even though we're working very well with this particular project with the Marine Institute and with Simon's team to look at postmortems, they have to be very selective about what animals they take in, because they really need really fresh animals, because otherwise you're just going to end up with inconclusive results. And it's a lot of resources that you put into that, and unfortunately you very, very seldom can actually draw a very firm conclusion from a post-mortem.
Establishing cause of death is very difficult, even, as I said, a fresh animal in a controlled environment. But there's still samples you can get. You could look in the stomach. Plastic won't be deteriorating. So there's a spectrum of things you can get depending on the freshness of it. I agree with you, Ferdia.
Simon, thank you very much. Sorry, Richard, you want to ask one last question?
You mentioned plastic there, Simon. Suppose whales would encounter things like barrel jellyfish. The great baleen is open and you get this huge object stuck in it. It must have a mechanism for expelling such items from the mouth. When a piece of plastic comes in, a large piece of plastic, what does it do? Can it cope? Or does it swallow it back thinking it's just a nice soft jellyfish?
I wonder how they avoid jellyfish. I've been watching basking sharks feeding and they seem to avoid jellyfish as well, which is impressive. I don't know. I mean, some plastic does pass through the gut. And we have done a lot of work on plastics. We did over 500 post-mortems since the early 90s and 8.5% of the animals we looked at had large plastic in their intestines or stomach, but never was it a cause of death. So they are ingesting this stuff. Some of it gets lodged and may lead to all sorts of blockages, but a lot of it, I think, is actually passes through the system as well. So I don't think plastics is a big issue in terms of whales and dolphins. It's a big issue with regarding other things, and it's a disgrace in the marine environment, but it's not a significant cause of death. So even
that,
if it had plastic
whale, the Cuvier's beaked whale,
for sure.
That plastic definitely killed that.
Definitely, yeah, and it does kill some without a doubt. You see sperm whales emaciated, washed up in the med. I would be very surprised if this fin whale had plastic in its stomach, or certainly any amount that would cause its death. So, yeah, it is an issue for some, but it's not in terms of, like, Ferdia works for a conservation organisation. You have to have limited resources. You put it to what is the best on the bigger picture. An individual whale dying of plastic impaction of its gut is unfortunate for the whale, but is that an effect of the population level? Probably not. Are you going to use your resources to investigate that? It's probably not a good use of limited resources.
No, but you need to know, because it does reflect how we're impacting on the oceans.
Oh, totally.
And that's why it's important to know these kind of
and
things.
So we can media attention. I
absolutely
agree, totally,
and it makes us more aware of how delicate the environment is. Anyway, Simon Barrow, Chief Science Officer and CEO of the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group and lecturer at GMIT. Thank you very much indeed, Simon. And also to Ferdy Marnell, who's Head of Animal Ecology at the National Parks and Wildlife Service. And we'll put a link to the National Parks and Wildlife Service contact details on our website, which is rte.ie/money. Guys, Ferdy, thank you very much indeed.